So, Helena, are you popular over at the FDA?
Oh, that's a tough question.
I thought you were going to laugh.
I think it's mixed. I do sometimes joke that I won't be allowed back in there, back in the building. We'll see. They still take my calls, so.
Helena Bonamiller-Evich writes about food policy for a digital publication she founded called Food Fix. So it makes sense that she's got the Food and Drug Administration on speed dial, even though inside the agency, she says, there's this joke that the F in FDA is silent.
Well, you know, FDA is so big in that it covers like something like 20% of consumer spending, right? So it's drugs, it's medical devices, it's microwaves and cosmetics. Food is a much lower priority issue at FDA. And that's just the truth of the matter.
Is baby formula considered food?
Yes, it is considered food.
Baby formula, particularly the baby formula shortage, is one of the reasons Helena worries the FDA is not exactly thrilled to hear from her. She's covered the chain of decisions leading up to the shortage with meticulous care. And this might surprise you, but Helena says this formula shortage is still going on.
When I go to my Safeway on Capitol Hill here in Washington, the supply looks kind of, it's like half-ish stocked. And that's not normal. And we're, 7 months into this? That's not normal. And I really don't know when it's going to return to normal. I think probably it's going to be next year. In 2023, I really have doubts about it returning to normal this winter.
As Helena waits out the shortage, she's also been waiting on this report, an explanation from the FDA about how a single plant in Sturgis, Michigan, first might have sickened babies, and then, when the government tried to clean things up, triggered a nationwide run on infant formula. A couple weeks back, this report finally came out.
I was like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to read this. And I was actually about to go on a podcast. And so I opened it right away and I skimmed it. And I went, oh my gosh, this doesn't answer any of my questions. And I tweeted right away, like, wow, this is pretty vague. I did have high hopes for it and it came nowhere close to meeting them.
Today on the show, why there are still so few answers about this continuing crisis for families. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Parents of small infants probably will not forget what happened this spring for a long time, but I wonder if for the rest of my listeners, you can just remind me of that TikTok. Like, where would you start the story of this formula shortage?
Yeah, I think the Cliff Notes version is the summer before this all happened, so there was a recall in February, the summer before, we started to see kind of weird stocking.
So we're talking like a year ago, summer 2021.
Yes. Like, you know, there's so many supply chain issues right now across all products, right? We've all seen this, whether it's couches or whatever. So infant formula was starting to get affected. There started to be some lower in-stock rates, which just were kind of off, right? And that fall of 2021, FDA got it the first report of an infant who had been hospitalized with Chronobacter sakazaki, which is a bacteria that rarely causes infections, but when it does in infants can be very deadly. And this infant had been consuming formula from Abbott Nutrition, and they reported it to FDA that this infant was in the ICU for like 20 days. So in September, they get a report. They don't go inspect the facility. FDA, you know, logs the report. I think one report, it's hard to know, like, what would the action be, right? It's like millions of kids are getting formula. But then in October, a whistleblower from the same plant that made that formula sends a like 30-page memo to FDA like, hey, I've got real concerns about the food safety in this plant.
What was the whistleblower alleging? Because there were a lot of allegations here, is my understanding.
Yeah, they were alleging some pretty egregious food safety lapses, like poor or incomplete record keeping or not keeping equipment up, some issues with like things like the infant formula cans not being properly sealed, things that would be really concerning to anyone who knows anything about food safety. Sanitation logs, just a lot of like a poor culture too of food safety, the fears of retaliation if you raised concerns about food safety internally, things like that. And this is a really big plant. 20%, something like 20% of America's infant formula was coming out of this plant. So this is a big player in the whole space.
And the whistleblower, I mean, this is a 30-plus page report that this person sends in. So pretty detailed, like not just a letter saying, hey, I have some worries, but a point-by-point assessment.
Yes.
With concrete examples of things that have gone wrong in their eyes.
Yes, very specific examples. And they sent this to several very senior FDA officials and also regional FDA officials. They sent it by email and hard copy. And one of the big questions we still have is like, why didn't the agency respond more quickly? So they didn't interview that whistleblower till December. They sent this memo in October. They have said since, oh, you know, there were mailroom issues, people are remote, the hard copies like didn't make it to the right people. But, you know, it was also emailed to several people, to several really key FDA officials. And since then, we have another employee from that plant, former employee who has stepped forward and confirmed many of those allegations. The other thing that happens right at this time is they get more reports of hospitalization and even infant deaths. So like in the winter, they got three more reports of infants who had been seriously sickened with Chronobacter, who had consumed formula from that plant. So all of these red flags are coming in a few months period, and FDA finally goes into that plant to see what's going on January 31st. So months, you know, go by in between. And when they go in there, they find really serious food safety violations. So they use the term insanitary conditions. And the FDA commissioner would later basically call the conditions egregious.
After that inspection found unsanitary conditions at the Abbott Nutrition plant, formula started being recalled. That, combined with a supply shortage that was already going on, meant a lot of parents couldn't find the products they needed to feed their infants. By the spring, fingers were pointing at the FDA. Across the country, parents and policymakers were asking why it took the agency 6 months to pull potentially deadly formula off store shelves. They were also wondering why the agency hadn't caught unsanitary conditions before they got bad enough to shut down production. For its part, the FDA promised an extensive investigation was underway.
They really pushed off a lot of questions. you know, they were always responsive. They would respond, but they wouldn't necessarily answer the questions. And a lot of the responses were, you know, we're going to do a thorough review. We know there's questions about the timeline. It was something that FDA Commissioner Robert Califf used a lot in the congressional hearings that were held in late spring responding to this crisis.
I believe we have the facts delineated at this point, and we have initiated an internal after-action review so that we can make improvements to prevent delays like this in the future and improve our decision-making.
So the fact that there was an investigation ongoing became a kind of shield.
Yes, absolutely.
So last week, the report comes out, and I've taken a look at it. I mean, I know you understand it much more deeply than I do. The first thing that stood out to me, this thing is 10 pages long, which isn't a lot. And one of the first things in it is the author saying, huh, like, isn't it funny that I'm writing this, but I'm a veterinarian? And you look at that and you think, I think maybe you didn't understand the assignment.
Well, one of the reasons why Steve Solomon, who's the head of the Center for Veterinary Medicine, so it makes sense that he's a veterinarian for his role at FDA. One of the reasons he was charged with overseeing that was because he was seen as not involved in the initial response. And so a big question here is, how does FDA review itself? How do you grade yourself, especially if you were involved? What if you were one of the officials who got this document or got the email or maybe got the email and didn't read it or didn't see it? It's hard for you to grade yourself and to really give an honest accounting of what happened.
That's a legitimate concern.
For sure. But that's not, we didn't end up getting any of the answers anyway. So yes, a lot of heartburn over just the lack of detail. I mean, he says that like more than 60 FDA officials were interviewed for this review, and there's not a single quote or detail. I mean, you're a journalist. If you do 60 interviews, and I have done 60 interviews for projects, you expect there to be this like richness and detailed picture that would emerge from something like that. That's a very intensive process. And that is not what we got in this document.
Yeah. The thing that stood out to me is that the authors of this report didn't show their work. Like, it's a list of recommendations, mm-hmm. but there's not a lot of support for why those recommendations are being made. Because I think I read this report, and as a journalist, of course, I want a narrative. I want a story. And it definitely doesn't give that. But I think the wider problem is that there's no evidence that's presented of like, here's what went wrong and why and how we're going to do it better in the future. And so even without a narrative, which of course I'm a sucker for, there was another problem.
I agree with you. I mean, it's almost impossible to tell how they arrived at the recommendations. And I guess one of the specifics that was revealed in there is an admission that, or an acknowledgement, I should say, that FDA inspectors are given very little infant formula specific training. And that stood out to me as sort of a new little tidbit, but again, does not answer some of the fundamental questions, like why, you know, these problems weren't found earlier. And then also, what has been done in the last year to fix that? We are now a full year away from that first infant formula hospitalization report. And what has been done? And I have not gotten a very clear and specific answer to that question either.
After the break, if accountability isn't coming from the FDA, who can stop the next formula shortage?
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output. bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
One of the interesting things reading this report is that it doesn't respond to questions you and I have as journalists, certainly, but it also doesn't respond to questions that Abbott Nutrition, the formula manufacturer at the center of this shortage, has raised. Like, Abbott has maintained all throughout this that there is no definitive link between their formula and illnesses of infants. Is it possible that the shutdown of their facility was for nothing?
I think it is definitely possible that there are infants getting Cronobacter from other places that are not infant formula. We know that Cronobacter sakazaki is a bacteria that lives in the environment. It's not uncommon to find it in kitchens. And so I can understand that case that they're making. And it is true that there is no definitive link. There's no DNA link that puts these cases and matches them to any findings in formula. So Abbott is technically correct that there, you know, an FDA has said basically we cannot definitively rule in or rule out that the formula was the cause of these specific illnesses.
The fact is, most experts doubt that the Cronobacter that made infants sick was just lying around on someone's kitchen counter, even if the link to Abbott's facilities is still circumstantial. Helena says, even if kids were getting sick just from their environment, the FDA has a responsibility to figure this out to prevent the next formula shortage.
If all of this is coming from kitchens, which most food safety experts don't think that, they think that there is a formula factor here. They think that formula, you know, we know that there have been cases in the past linked to formula, so this is a known concern. But if it were coming from kitchens, well, we should know that too, right? Because that would mean that there are infants dying every year because parents have no idea that this is a concern. So I think either way, there's a public health issue here and there's a public health imperative to get to the bottom of what is going on here.
Another thing that stood out to me about this report is that the FDA kind of shrugs its shoulders over the impact of their failure here. Like, they don't really talk about the consolidation of the formula industry and how that had this disastrous impact with the supply chain. They have one finding, which is that the FDA and other federal agencies do not have the authority, expertise, or resources to manage supply chain issues, which to me feels like shrugging their shoulders, as opposed to saying this authority would help us, or perhaps that authority lies with this agency over there. Did that strike you too?
Yeah. So to be fair to FDA, they don't have the authority really to monitor or keep tabs on supply chain or stocking rates for infant formula. They actually had to buy private sector retail data because they didn't have it.
Yikes.
Yeah. And FDA does do some supply monitoring on different drugs, right? Because there's certain drugs, like I imagine insulin is one of them, where any shortage would be life-threatening. So there are parts of FDA that do this kind of supply chain monitoring and sort of keeping an eye on that. But we don't have that on the food side for any product that I'm aware of. So FDA has tried to get Congress to give them more authority and more resources. And I think that is one area where, you know, technically that wasn't FDA's job. In this case, it seems like it was just no one's job to keep track of whether or not we had a stable supply of formula. And like, it just raises a lot of questions about food security. And I think it really revealed that we had not thought about this and about what could go wrong. And it's just an incredibly vulnerable situation to be in.
It sounds like you have some empathy for the FDA, but also think maybe they've bitten off more than they can chew here with their resources. I mean, they're being made to bite it off. It's not like they're doing it themselves. But it sounds like you're saying they're kind of doing too much.
It's interesting. Is it that they're doing too much, or is it that we've never set them up to do what we expected them to do? I mean, it is a really interesting conundrum. I think the bottom line where I come down is, like, if you ask a consumer what they think FDA does on food, there's a huge gap between what consumers think FDA is doing, like really actively regulating food manufacturers or food additives or all these other things. There's a huge gap between what consumers think FDA is doing and what they're actually doing.
What do people think they're doing?
I think people think there's a lot more oversight, like just regular oversight. I think people assume that most food additives have to be approved before they're put on the market. That's not the case. Remember when the pink sauce thing went viral on TikTok?
It's the pink sauce everyone's talking about. It looks like Pepto-Bismol, and the colored condiment went viral after this woman posted video of her eating it with fried chicken.
So pink sauce went viral, and it was essentially this Florida chef was, like, making the sauce, right?
But since it's made with oil, it's a lot more, like, buttery and oily than ranch.
And it went viral because people were getting packages, I guess, that were not refrigerated and mislabeled.
This customer says it came like this in the mail in a Ziploc bag that leaked.
No, ma'am, we're not trying this. Look at this. It stinks.
But there's this moment where the F and FDA was, like, trending on social media because this person who makes the pink sauce was responding to a consumer question where someone was like, is this FDA approved? And it's like, FDA would never have any involvement with, like, a new sauce on the market. Like, it's just not anything that they would be doing. And, you know, it was this really wild example on social media, I think, of perceptions. And what I find is that when I explain to people sort of how FDA works, how, you know, there's virtually, you know, very little actual FDA oversight of those facilities, I just think people find that kind of surprising. Like, oh, you wouldn't think that would be the case.
So with the formula shortage and everything that took place to get us to that place where formula was in short supply, if that's a whodunit, like, what happened here? What was the cause? Do you think that mystery is ever going to be solved?
We have one more shot at this, and that is the Inspector General. The Office of the Inspector General under HHS is investigating.
Health and Human Services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have an Inspector General report. You know, these things take forever. So I don't know when we'll see that, but that is really, I think, the only shot we have here of getting kind of a 360-degree accounting of what happened.
Are you optimistic about it? Do you think it'll be better than the report you've just gotten?
It has to be better than what we just got from FDA. I am optimistic about it, yeah.
I read one piece of analysis in the Washington Post that basically posited that the formula shortage wasn't a complete disaster because lots of people stepped up to fill the void. I kind of wondered, given all the reporting you've done around the formula shortage, whether you'd agree with that assessment.
Well, I think it wasn't a disaster, but I'm not sure if I would consider it a success that much of that response and much of the ways that parents and caregivers made this work was basically like the labor of moms and parents going online and creating, like, you know, mutual support where they would ship formula, like, across the country. So one mom in one state would go, oh, I found this formula, who needs it? And, you know, that was really expensive and inefficient. So in some ways, it's great that consumers found ways to support each other, but I'm not sure that's a good outcome. And still today, I think short of, again, we know we have enough calories for our babies, there is technically enough formula. we still have a lot of stress around this, and we still have a lot of parents scrambling and spending a ton of time figuring out how to navigate this. It's not normal, and it's really not okay.
Helena, I'm so grateful for your reporting and your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Happy to be here anytime.
Helena Bodemiller-Evich is the founder of Food Fix, a publication about food policy. And that's our show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support us is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus and sign up. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Mary Wilson, Carmel Delshad, and Madeline Ducharme. We are getting a ton of support right now from Anna Phillips and Jared Downing. We are led by Alicia Montgomery and Joanne Levine. And I'm Mary Harris. I will catch you back in this feed tomorrow. Talk to you then.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.